Matt, one of the leaders at Maybridge. Great to have the privilege of speaking to you, as always. And especially if you're just checking out church or Maybridge in particular, you're very welcome. Every week, we look at something in the Bible together as a church. And at the moment, we're meandering through Matthew's Gospel, an eyewitness account of Jesus' life, which is fascinating in its own right, but also has meaning and application to life today. It tells us what God's like and what we're like and how through Jesus, God meets with us. It's incredible. Today's passage, though, is a bit of an unusual one. It's sort of sandwiched between a few really memorable stories, but this is a section nobody remembers. This is nobody's favourite Bible passage. Nobody made it into a car sticker or a fridge magnet. But dig beneath the surface, it tells us something really important about Jesus, I think. The passage is Matthew 8 from verse 14. The whole of Matthew chapter 8, you could say, is designed to show the authority of Jesus, the power of Jesus. And it begins with sort of two power stories and ends with two power stories. And then there's this bit in the middle. And while it does show us that Jesus is powerful, it has another big point to make, which is all about the cost of following Jesus, the price. So I'm going to divide this into two bits for today, the power and the price, and then have a think about what on earth this has to do with people today. So firstly, the power. When Jesus came into Peter's house, he saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her, and she got up and went and began to wait on him. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. I love that on Mother's Day, we've bumped into the passage that has a mother-in-law in it. That was not planned at all. If you were with us last week, you'll know that here Jesus is in the town of Capernaum in northern Israel, because of course all the best people are from the north of their country, we all know that. Jesus is sort of new on the scene, he's becoming well known, but he's not super well known just like he is now. And one of his earliest followers is this man called Peter. Now it was normal for Jewish teachers like Jesus to take on disciples. Jesus had 12. They were basically followers who really meant it. They were really keen. They were committed to learning from that teacher. Peter's one of these guys. Peter was from this town of Capernaum. He was a fisherman. It's right on the top of the Sea of Galilee. If you go there today, they've actually built a church over what they think was his house. It's like a giant spider with a transparent floor so you can sort of walk over it and see Peter's house while you're at church. Not that we need to do any of that as followers of Jesus, but it's interesting to imagine Peter living in this really tiny place with some of his family. Anyway, Peter invites Jesus into his house. Jesus is willing to go in, which might seem straightforward to us, though maybe less so in this pandemic. But at the time, this meant that Peter was showing great affection for Jesus by inviting his teacher, his rabbi, into his home. And where lots of religious teachers would have seen this as beneath them, Jesus doesn't. He has great authority and power and all this, but he's also very relational, down to earth. He has no problem in going into Peter's house and meeting his family. Last week, there was also a miracle story. And just as last time, we see that the author of this, Matthew, doesn't make a massive deal out of miracles and go on and on about them. He just reports them and then moves on. Peter's mother-in-law had a fever. How sick was she? Well, was it life-threatening? We don't know. But Jesus heals her. And there is an old joke around this passage that says that Peter never actually forgave Jesus for healing his mother-in-law. But more seriously, what we've seen in the last few passages has been remarkable. The religious leaders of the time would have seen lepers and Gentiles and even women as less important and maybe not even worth bothering with. And yet, in the last few weeks, we've seen Jesus heal lepers and Gentiles and now a woman, challenging how everybody would have thought about God. And Matthew uses this to transition to the bigger picture. He says, when evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. Now that one sentence is loaded with strange things from our point of view. You've got both demon possession and supernatural miraculous healing. So to comment on both, but briefly for the sake of time. Firstly, demonic possession. We live in a culture that's very sceptical of the demonic. It doesn't fit at all with a modern Western view of the world. And it should be said that in that regard, we're quite unusual. We tend to be culturally very quick to point to mental health problems as a more likely explanation than the influence of demons. And I think we're right to emphasise that. But that doesn't mean that the demonic doesn't exist. In fact, most cultures historically and today, accept that demonic powers exist. What are they? Demons are beings that are not God and don't have the power of God, but look to exert influence over humans in a negative way. Sometimes they might make this influence obvious, but mostly in our part of the world, they like to lurk in the background unseen. The way the Bible tells us about demons, the idea is that we should not be naive, we should be aware that they exist, but we should also not be overly interested in them. At one point elsewhere in the story, we see Jesus' disciples cast out demons from other people and they get very excited about it, it's amazing, but Jesus quickly moves them on to the bigger picture of their relationship with God being more important. But in this passage, Jesus himself casts demons out of people. What does that even mean? The text says he drove them out with a word. Again, no big song and dance, no weird incantation or anything like that. Whenever Jesus casts out demons, he basically just tells them to leave, and his authority is so great that they go. Simple. You and I don't have the same power as Jesus, but it seems that when Jesus is named, when Jesus is depended on, when he's celebrated, demons run away. They run a mile. I actually knew a couple once, then they weren't from a Christian background, a church background, nothing like that. They were experimenting with different religions and ideas and exploring, and they dabbled with all sorts of things, including a Ouija board, to try to connect with demonic powers. Very serious stuff. And their story is, they mentioned all sorts of other known leaders and religious influences from history with no response. But as soon as they mentioned Jesus, the demon they were speaking to went crazy. And ultimately, this led this couple to exploring Jesus more, and they became Christians and they got rid of all the demon stuff. It's a really mad story, and it's definitely not an invitation to experiment with that sort of thing, but it's telling the name of Jesus is the one that demons run away from still. If there's one thing to have in your mind around demons, it's this. They're powerful, but Jesus is more powerful. Powerful, but Jesus is more powerful. That's the main thing. Secondly, healing the sick. One of the things that Jesus does repeatedly in the Gospels is heal sick people. It's one of the things that makes people read the Gospels and think, is this made up? Could anyone really do all these things? Seems a bit of a stretch. Pretty much any time anyone is healed by Jesus, and we saw it with Peter's mother-in-law, it's made out not to be a big deal. It's nearly always in service of a bigger point. Jesus heals out of compassion, but he repeatedly uses the opportunity given by the extra attention to talk about things that he thinks are actually more important. We tend to be drawn to the miraculous and spectacular. It grabs our interest, of course. We love the idea of being healed and we're impressed by powerful demonstrations, obviously. Jesus is different. What are miracles to us seem to be routine to him. And he's concerned with things like character and trusting God and what we make of him, the internal stuff. But we might still ask, did these miracles happen? The early dating of the gospel records, and we have manuscript evidence of this, to within a few decades of these events, tells us that at minimum, a huge number of people who were present believe that they did, at minimum. Plus, external historical sources that had nothing to do with the Bible agree that Jesus was known to heal people. Basically, it's pretty established, it's pretty clear that Jesus had a reputation widely, both between his followers and not, that he was someone who could heal people. But most of all, the big issue is the resurrection of Jesus. If that happened, and there is even more reason, I think, to believe that it did, all the other healing miracles are small time in comparison. If he could do that, he could do these. And they're also connected. What Jesus does in resurrection is shadowed by how he restores people in the time leading up to it. In fact, when Matthew records why Jesus drove out demons and healed the sick, he says, this was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. You see, 800 years before Jesus was born, this guy Isaiah told the nation what would happen one day. The person who would come along and sort out the world's problems, according to Isaiah 53, would take up our infirmities and bear our diseases. Jesus does that for people throughout the Gospels, and then he does it once and for all in death and resurrection. What Matthew's doing, and we've said this a few times in the series so far, is writing to Jewish people who are really into the Old Testament and showing that Jesus fulfills what it says, that he's the one, he's the Jewish Messiah, he's the one who's going to come and sort out the nation and even the world. And one of the many ways that Jesus shows that he's the one is that he lives out what was predicted by Isaiah. Any Jewish person reading Matthew would have had loads of background ideas about what the Messiah would do. And so again and again and again, Matthew shows us that Jesus fulfills all the stories and ideas and expectations of the Old Testament. It's incredible. So that's the power of Jesus. The author is at great pains to demonstrate it, to tell us about it. But right then, when he deliberately says, look, this is the person Isaiah was talking about, look at him. When he builds Jesus up right in the middle of chapter 8, all about the awesome power of Jesus, there's a sudden change of pace. Everything is brought back down to earth with a bang. And so secondly, we get to this, the price. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then the teacher of the law came to him and said, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Jesus replied, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Another disciple said to him, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. But Jesus told him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. This is really like having a bucket of cold water thrown over you. Up to this moment, it's all the greatness of Jesus, teaching, miracles, compassion, authority to drive out demonic powers. It's all very impressive, and that's on purpose. The author wants anyone who reads this to be bowled over by Jesus, to stand back and go, well, he's not an ordinary person, is he? He is the Jewish Messiah, but maybe he's more besides. He's God on earth. That's the goal of Matthew's gospel, or at least one of them. But if it was just about being impressed by Jesus, he would not have included a passage like this. If it was some devious attempt to manipulate people into signing their life away to a religious system, this section would not have made the final version. Because right here, Matthew shows us people reacting to Jesus positively, but rather than leap on it with great enthusiasm and say, oh, you've realised, well done, just follow everything I say now, Jesus almost sounds like he's trying to put people off. Matthew records that Jesus planned to take a boat across the lake. There's a crowd around him, thinks it's right to withdraw for a while. That's the first indicator. Jesus is not just about lapping up all the popularity. And then someone speaks up. A teacher of the law came to him and said, teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go. This is a significant moment. Until now, lots of people have been impressed by Jesus. Peasant crowds, a Gentile centurion, the first disciples who were uneducated men. But this is a teacher of the law, a professional religious teacher, in other words. This is like getting a seal of approval from the establishment. This has not happened to Jesus before, as far as we know. And it's not just that he thinks well of Jesus. He says, I'll follow you wherever you go. That means he's offering to be a disciple himself, to follow what he says, and whatever he does from now on, he'll go with him. It's a staggering thing for somebody who was a professional teacher himself to say it. It looks incredibly humble, actually. But he addresses Jesus as his teacher. It's very respectful, but he has Jesus in a certain role. He's thinking, Jesus, you're an amazing teacher. I want to be one of your guys. Teach me stuff. You're the expert. And he's not wrong. Jesus is a great teacher, but he doesn't go any further. He wants to learn from Jesus, sure, but that's the limit. And as usual, Jesus replies in a way that nobody else would. I would have said something like, oh, cheers, mate, that's nice of you. Yeah, if you want to learn from me, you'd be very welcome. Seems like a very wise move. Jesus says, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. The answer's all about facing reality. Jesus does not want to be followed cheaply. Foxes and birds have places to sleep, places they can rest. Jesus does not at this time. Now, it wasn't that Jesus had no money and so he had nowhere to sleep. It was more that living in his ways, genuinely following him, was a full-time expectation. It was relentless. The phrase Son of Man that he uses was lifted out of the Old Testament. And in the same way that Matthew points back to what Isaiah predicted, another book called Daniel used this weird phrase Son of Man to talk about the same person. But this time it wasn't about healing from sickness and so on. It was about having eternal glory and power being worshipped by people from all over the world. Really big stuff. Jesus uses the title Son of Man for himself loads and loads in the Gospels for reasons that we're not going to go into now. But the point in this case is that even though Jesus sees himself as this great figure, he doesn't live like it. He's supernatural and glorious, he says, but he lives in a sense with less comfort than a fox or a bird. And so basically this religious teacher comes to him and says, yeah, I'll follow you. Well, you know what you're on about. I'll come after you. And Jesus effectively replies and says, are you sure? Because what I'm asking isn't easy. I'm more than a good moral teacher, which is why the standard is more than just good morals. You need to recognise who I am, and following me is not going to be comfortable. It's relentless. It's all of life. It's all the time. It's all that you have. Right after this, somebody else pipes up, which is probably a relief to the first guy. This person probably isn't a religious teacher, just a normal bloke who's thinking about following Jesus more seriously. And he says, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." His commitment is different. Notice this time he addresses Jesus as Lord. He's not seeing Jesus as a teacher, but probably as more. And his words seem to be saying, just, you know, let me bury my dad. And when that's all done with, I'll follow you even when it's hard work. I'm all in. Just let me bury my dad. And that again seems like a very respectful offer. And when you read it, Jesus' reply seems really harsh. Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Well, most commentators think that what was actually happening here, it's not that the man's dad had just died and Jesus doesn't care about the funeral. If the man's dad had just died and wasn't buried yet, he wouldn't have been here listening to Jesus in the first place. He'd have other responsibilities at this time. It's more likely that the man is saying, let me continue to follow my dad, maybe working in the family business, doing things my dad's way. And then one day in the future, when my dad's gone and I don't have those expectations, then I'll switch over and I'll wholeheartedly follow you, Jesus. That seems to be what he's saying. And again, that's a pretty big offer. To tell someone that after your parents, you're next in line in life is a massive thing to say. And in that culture, the obligation to your parents was considered to be huge, much more than for us. But once again, Jesus doesn't seem impressed, and he says something that sounds very strange. Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. This is one of those things that Jesus says, which is a crowd gasping sort of a moment. Burying your dad was such a priority that nobody would dare put anything above it, with the exception of one thing. Your duty to God was greater than to your parents. Nothing else, just God. And so when Jesus says, follow me, in the context of the man wanting to bury his dad, Jesus is asking, you can say you'll follow me, but do you understand? I'm asking you to put me in the position that is reserved for God himself. That's what I'm asking. Are you ready for that? Let the dead bury their own dead. Such a punchy phrase. Do you see the distinction he's making? Either follow Jesus or be one of the dead, i.e. the spiritually dead. And it's not that only spiritually dead people attend funerals, but I think what Jesus is getting at is more about the obligations. If you follow your parents or anybody ahead of him, you'll be dead spiritually. And of course, building your life around the expectations and obligations of someone who's dead is not a good long-term strategy. And so in both these very short conversations, Jesus' message is sort of the same. The cost of following him is huge, eye-wateringly, breathtakingly huge. The first person wants to wholeheartedly follow Jesus' teaching, and the answer is, okay, I'm more than a teacher, and are you sure? It's blooming difficult. The second person knows Jesus is greater than a teacher, but he still wants to make him second to his dad. And the answer is, follow me first, because following anybody else means spiritual death. It's heavy stuff. And between them, we can see that in the middle of all the impressive things Jesus does, as soon as anyone makes noises about following him, he doesn't tell them to just blindly get on with the programme. He says, no, wait, think about this. Do you know who I am or what I'm asking for? I'm the eternal God and I want everything that you have. So it's strong stuff. It's not a light and fluffy passage. It's not a fridge magnet one. But it is the words of Jesus to anyone thinking about following him. And it's a challenge to people at any stage of their spiritual journey. And for us at Maybridge here in 2021, or anyone joining us and checking us out, there's a few things to reflect on. Firstly, following Jesus can't be done on the cheap. There's no such thing as following Jesus the easy way. If you have a nice, easy life on every single level, but still think you're following Jesus, something probably doesn't add up somewhere. We have to be clear about this, though. We live, broadly speaking, in a comfortable time and place. I know things aren't good right now, because pandemic's terrible, but broadly speaking, we're not in a war. We're not in a country where being a Christian is illegal. The worst thing that will happen to us, specifically for following Jesus, is probably being unpopular. That's probably the worst thing that will happen to us. So it's very easy for many of us to do Christian things and still live a fairly nice life. But it's also deceptive. When the culture around us doesn't force us to ask ourselves whether we're willing to follow Jesus, you can go into autopilot. You can live Christianly without any sense of cost. And so because our culture lets us be Christians, no problem, we need to constantly remind ourselves that following Jesus is actually very costly. The church in this country is wonderful in so many ways. We've made following Jesus cheap when we have no right to do so. We baptize people because they've been to church a number of times. We expect very little of each other. We fear accountability because we're terrified of looking judgmental. We dip in and out of commitments at the slightest inconvenience. We share with each other all these nice, encouraging Bible verses that we know, and often we ignore the tough stuff that Jesus says more than anyone. And he speaks the truth out of love. We often say nothing out of indifference. Actually, following Jesus always comes at a cost. He makes demands on your time, your money, your reputation, your politics, your relationships, your employment. If you don't count a cost to following him, it's probably because you aren't. Hard words. Do you have any idea how many people lived in hardship or even were killed for their faith in the last 2,000 years so that you and I could hear about Jesus and follow him ourselves? The opportunities that we have were built on the sacrifices of thousands who came before. It was in the news recently about the state of the church in Iraq right now. In 2003, not long ago, there were 1.4 million Christians in Iraq. Now it's 250,000 and falling. And that's not because people stop being Christians. It's because they're being killed or driven out of the country. A church leader there, the Reverend Bashar Wadar, said that after 1,400 years of persecution, 1,400 years, the church in Iraq faces extinction. And his words were, "Those of us who remain must be ready to face martyrdom." It's very simple for him. That's what Christians are like in Iraq. They've been following Jesus under threat for 1,400 years. And think about the things that we get stuck on when our preferences aren't met. I'm glad of the comforts we have here, but if you follow Jesus when it's challenging, if it costs something, then that's when you know it's authentic and it's real. That's why after the glory of healing people and casting out demons, it all looks exciting and dynamic and everyone wants to be involved. Jesus in this passage brings everyone back down to earth. Healing and miracles are great, they are. But real faith is found when it's difficult and costly and even demands your life. Second thought, following Jesus will disappoint people around you. It'll disappoint people. It's interesting to be talking about this on Mother's Day, when we remember the great women in our lives, mothers and other women who've cared for us and love us, and it's right that we do. But one of the things that can hold us back from following Jesus is what people expect from us, family in particular. That was the problem for one of the people in the passage. And we all know that we can be pulled away from following Jesus by money and power and comfort and all sorts of things. But how often do we think about how we can be pulled away from following Jesus by people that are close to us? Good people. Our families have a huge influence. What we experience growing up shapes so much of how we see the world, our priorities, our assumptions, everything. When you're really small, the people that raise you are like God to you. They control everything. They dictate everything. And for the most part, families are a wonderful, brilliant thing, obviously. But even the best parents, the most supportive and loving parents, can load us with expectations. Expectations about how we make decisions, the jobs that we'll do, who we'll marry, how we use our money, and what we do with Jesus. And that's true even of Christian parents, because we all get things wrong. I'm a Christian and a parent. Ask me if I want my kids to follow Jesus, and I'll quickly say yes. But I'm certain that if they do, the day will come when I don't want them to do something that God does. It'll happen. If, for example, if my little girl grows up and says, "I don't think I should go to university because I think God's called me to something else," my instinctive parent reaction would be to think, no, you're really bright. You should go to university. Then do something afterwards if you want to. Why would I think that? Because, well, I went to university. She's certainly cleverer than me. And I have this expectation. But in reality, she should do whatever God wants her to do over and above what I want her to do. It's hard to say, but it's true. The demand of Jesus is, put me above even your parents. Follow my wisdom, not theirs. Look at my expectations, not theirs. And that's incredibly hard. It doesn't mean our parents are always wrong, of course, but it's putting Jesus above even that. I know of a few people at Maybridge who are mocked or even rejected by their parents because of their faith. If that's you, you're amazing. What an inspiration. You're the people who know what's at stake and you follow Jesus anyway. What an example. You know the cost and your faith and example is stronger for it. I know other people who you have church-going Christian parents who are great in lots of ways, but they loaded you with expectations which have been damaging, which have messed up how you see God, which have made it about rules. And because it's hard to separate their expectations from his, it's now hard to work out what it means to be a Christian. Look at what Jesus expects, not what they expect. He can be trusted. I know a lot of others still who grew up and didn't have good parents at all, and they communicated to you that you were worthless or stupid or whatever. And in a sense, you still live under that story, that expectation of who you are and what your life will be. And as hard as Jesus' teaching is, he also says to you, come to me. Let me define you. Let me tell you what your life's about. Because what your parents told you is not the truth. It's not. Live under his expectations, his views, not theirs. And that leads to number three. We'll finish on this. Following Jesus is worth it. His teaching's really hard. He sets the bar higher than anyone else in history. When he's at his most popular, when people are most impressed by his teaching and miracles, it's him that says, yeah, but have you counted the cost? Have you? It's not cheap. And yet people still follow him to death worldwide. People risk or experience rejection from family, mockery, poor job prospects, discomfort, a lower standard of living, prison, even death. And they do it gladly. But why? Why would you put up with all that? Only one reason, and that's that you think it's worth it. Because you think that whatever this life throws at you, whatever you lose out on for being a follower of Jesus, following him is the path to life, rather than the path to death that comes with living underneath what anybody else says, parent or otherwise. It's because you think that someone who's cast out demons and heals the sick and claims to be the God of the universe while stepping in the home of an obscure fisherman and having compassion on his family who pulled off a resurrection is worth it. Jesus wants us to count the cost, but in counting, there's a right answer. The cost is worth it. The sums add up. Following Jesus is worth everything that we have. And so let me ask you, when was the last time you counted the cost personally? You may never have. If you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, I hope that this has made it clear that Jesus does want you to follow him, but he doesn't want you to do it blindly or because you like church or anything like that. Count the cost. But as someone who's been a Christian for a long time, it's worth it. It really is. But that's for you to wrestle with. On the other hand, if you're someone who would identify as a Christian, when did you last count the cost? It's not something we sit down and do very often, I suspect. But think through your life. Is being a Christian costing you anything right now? I don't mean is anything difficult. Something is always difficult. Pandemic's difficult for all of us. What I mean is anything costly right now, specifically because you follow Jesus? Whether it's family relationships, or your bank balance, or your reputation, whatever. Is it costing you to follow him right now? Are you ready for it to cost you in the season ahead? Because he is worth it. And if you've tried him, you know that's true. Let me pray. Father, we thank you that although you can do great things, you don't want us to just be impressed or just willing to follow Jesus cheaply. And we're sorry for when we do that. We acknowledge that he is worth following. Free us, please, from our addiction to comfort. Let us have that conviction that life is found in giving up ourselves, not just worshipping ourselves. Thank you that you didn't get us on the cheap, but the death of your son was as expensive as it gets, and yet you still chose to do it. Let the words of Jesus in this passage resonate with us. Let them shape how we think in the weeks ahead. And Lord, help us to count the cost and conclude again, or even for the first time for some of us, that it really is worth it. Amen.